Good afternoon, all. The case for argument this afternoon is Weishart v. Davis. Ms. Longsharp.
Chief Judge Flom, may it please the court. This afternoon, I'll be discussing the Brady and NAPU claims presented as the first issue in the brief. The state star witness, Gregory Scott Johnson, portrayed himself as a reluctant witness, referring to Mark Weishart as his brother and describing their relationship as very tight. Johnson acknowledged having some trouble with the law. He said that charges had yet to be filed for his burglary of a church, an act for which he felt horrible about, and had asked for the Lord's forgiveness.
Ms. Longsharp, could I get you to focus on something that I thought was brought out, at least for me, more in your reply brief than I had perhaps realized in the opening brief? You stress in your reply brief that Mr. Weishart's theory is not that he had some agreement with the prosecutor, but instead there were, in effect, benefits being bestowed that were within the scope of the request made by his counsel at the time of trial that were not mentioned independently of agreement. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so no agreement. And you also say that this distinction was made clear in the various filings that Mr. Weishart made, I guess particularly at the post-conviction stage in Indiana.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that the Indiana, of course, one can read the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion on post-conviction, and it's all about agreement. So your position is they simply overlooked it.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, so that gets me actually, in a sense, to my central question, which is what authority are you relying on for a duty of the prosecution to disclose, as it were, unilateral benefits?
Well,
non-agreement-based benefits.
As the United States Supreme Court made clear in cases such as Giglio versus the United States, mm-hmm. Impeachment evidence is exculpatory evidence and must be disclosed. For example, in Banks v. Dredke, the informant was paid $200. That fact was not disclosed. In United States versus Bagley, I believe, at issue there as well was a monetary amount, a benefit that was given.
Now, would the timing of these benefits make any difference? Is the record clear that Mr. Weishart had really actually received a benefit by the time he took the stand?
Mr. Johnson had,
Johnson, yeah.
The incident involving the Three Pigs Tavern occurred about 2 weeks prior to his testimony. It was at that moment that defense counsel, having heard rumors in the small Anderson, Indiana community, it's at that moment that defense counsel then went directly to Lieutenant John Moberly, who was then one of the two lead detectives, and asked him, have any charges against Gregory Scott Johnson been withheld? And the answer was no. The testimony at the post-conviction hearing on the part of the police officers is very clear. It was the next morning that they had a meeting with Gregory Scott Johnson. It was at that meeting where Gregory Scott Johnson asked them, would you make this felony arrest go away? Both detectives testify, although they can't recall exactly who made the phone call, that it was at that meeting that the phone call was made to Officer Reed, who was the arresting officer on both the public intoxication the night before, the felony arrest the night before, and the burglary investigation into the Three Pigs Tavern. It was at that meeting, and the testimony is unambiguous. It was at that meeting Johnson asked him to call Officer Reed. They did call Officer Reed. The theft charge vanished at that meeting. So Johnson had his Aladdin's lamp. He rubbed it, made a wish for a felony to go away, and the wish was granted. And that is unambiguous.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your brief, you say that the Brady violation consists of a failure to have disclosed promises. And in the second opinion of the Indiana Supreme Court, Weishart's contention is that the prosecutor failed to respond completely and accurately to a motion to reveal agreements between the state and Johnson. And then the court, of course, discusses the question whether there was an agreement.
The actual discovery motion that was filed by defense counsel, the initial discovery motion I believe filed in July of 1982, was labeled motion to reveal agreements. The content of that motion asks for, among other things, any instances of non-prosecution.
Well, are you saying the Indiana Supreme Court misconstrued the request?
I think there are at least two ways to look at it. One is the issue of whether or not, let me say this, the issue of whether or not there was an agreement on post-conviction did not arise until the Attorney General's office filed its brief. In the lead brief filed by Mr. Weishart, represented by post-conviction counsel, the claim there was they did not respond to the specific discovery request, the first one in writing, the second one oral, to disclose benefits or preferential treatment. I believe the word that they used in that brief, if memory serves, is benefit. The Indiana Supreme Court, for reasons unknown, latched on to the agreement. The term agreement, was there a deal between the two? Our position is either they did not address that issue, or if they did address that issue, if then their opinion could be read conceivably.
But you didn't argue this in your brief.
I believe we did, Your Honor.
In this brief? Where?
Yes, sir.
You argue that the Indiana Supreme Court misconstrued Weishart's argument?
Well, in the reply brief, we set forth exactly.
Well, isn't that a little late?
Our contention all along has been, I believe, Your Honor, if you'll...
I thought your argument in your main brief, at least, was that the Indiana Supreme Court was wrong to find that there was no agreement.
No, Your Honor. Our contention has been all along, as evidenced by the habeas petition itself, although in the habeas petition...
But if the Supreme Court of Indiana Supreme Court, if they say no agreement... Don't you have to say they've misconstrued your argument?
Either they misconstrued the argument.
Well, I don't get the either.
Well, I think one could look at what the Indiana Supreme Court did and say the Indiana Supreme Court held that the only thing that needs to be disclosed...
No, they didn't say that. They didn't say that.
One could look at it.
No, you can't say that. There's nothing in their opinion to suggest that. All they discussed in their opinion on the Brady claim is whether there was an agreement. They said there was no agreement.
Correct.
Now, they could be wrong, or they could have overlooked something.
Correct.
Now, I don't see where you argued that they overlooked something.
I believe, Your Honor, in directing you to the page... With my glasses.
Well, on page 14 of your opening brief, you begin your discussion of this issue, and you say whether they suppressed favorable evidence. The Indiana Supreme Court never addressed the issue presented during post-conviction proceedings, merely revisited a related claim, whether Scott Johnson was offered a deal. So you've already talked about the background of this in the earlier part of your brief. I mean, I have to say, I thought it came out much more clearly in the reply brief, but I don't know that you didn't say it in the opening brief. Because, I mean, you don't think the state is arguing that only agreements count for Brady, are you? I mean, that would be ridiculous.
I agree. But we have made that argument. I agree that it's a ridiculous position if indeed that is the position.
I mean, I think the real critical question is, did the Indiana Supreme Court know that it was being asked to decide not only agreements but benefits?
And I hope that it is clear, more clear, in our reply brief.
But where? I mean, I see the argument in the reply brief. But where is the indication that the argument was made to the Indiana Supreme Court?
We discussed this in footnote 3 on page 1 of the reply brief. But if I could, Judge Posner, also we have repeatedly said that our claim is not that there was an actual agreement, that it's about benefits and preferential treatment. Not once has the state alleged that we didn't present that claim below. And in fact, in the first brief we filed after the habeas petition in the district court, we specifically stated that we were dropping the actual deal claim.
Yes, but the confusion is that I thought you were arguing that, there wasn't a formal deal, but there was an implicit deal. I thought that was your argument. It was implicit that if he played ball with the prosecution, right, they'd go easy with him on the burglaries. Isn't that your argument?
No, Your Honor, because a deal or understanding is still a deal. If there was an understanding, a quid pro quo, if you will, an actual quid, you know, we're giving you these benefits, and whether it's not concrete written down, is there an understanding? That concept, I believe under Giglio, is still treated as a deal. The Indiana Supreme Court found
that. So do we have a deal or not a deal? I don't understand.
Personally, I think there was, but I've got a finding from the Indiana Supreme Court based on the testimony of all the police officers that they made no actual deal with Johnson.
Okay, now, the Indiana Supreme Court said, I'm looking at footnote 50, which is on page 23 of second opinion in the appendix. So, we believe that the cross-examination of these witnesses regarding this matter indicates a general awareness by Weishart's counsel of the conduct of the police in securing Johnson's testimony. And then in a later footnote, 67, the court says, Weishart's counsel attacked Johnson's credibility by questioning Johnson about, one, Johnson being a snitch for the police, and two, being investigated for numerous burglaries just before providing the police with a statement about Weishart and letters written by Weishart to Johnson. So didn't that put before the jury the fact that Johnson had much to gain from playing ball with the prosecutors?
To that I would say no. The testimony from Johnson is he was suspected in two burglaries. The testimony from Officer Tom Hay, which is the other witness who testifies to this at trial, says that Johnson was a suspect in two burglaries, one of which he was actually the victim of, first of all. What's not in front of the jury is this. I mean, so we go through and we look at Johnson's testimony, and what comes out is he's got a public intoxication arrest, maybe more. He's contempt of court. He's got a juvenile past and this church burglary thing, plus a suspect in another burglary. What the jury doesn't get from that is that Johnson actually received tangible benefits from the police, that he had this Aladdin's lamp.
What difference does it make? If you're a criminal, and there are all sorts of charges hanging over your head, then, of course, if the government says, well, we'd like you to testify against this fellow Weishart, of course you're going to turn somersaults to do that because you anticipate a quid pro quo. And that's what I understand Weishart's lawyer said that to the jury. So
yes.
I'm wondering about the incremental effect on the, because we have a situation where we have a confession. So I'm wondering what incremental effect on the jury's thinking this additional disclosure that you want would have had.
Well, Johnson portrays himself as somebody who is a friend of Mark Weishart. He doesn't want to be there. He's there simply to tell the truth because he has to.
And we know why he has to, because the prosecutor has him over a barrel. And that's what Weishart's counsel brought out, and that's what the jury would understand.
A hope for leniency is one thing. Anybody, any snitch in the jail, if you will, who comes to the prosecutor and says, "I'd like to, you know, I've heard this over at the jail. I'd like to come testify in this case," has a hope for leniency.
But you see, that's where this deal thing is so important, because the implication conveyed certainly in your opening brief is that there was a deal. Because yes, a deal is different from just kind of free. Floating hope of some kind of benefit, but there was no deal. So then the question is, since there was no deal, you more or less accept that. I think we're bound by the Indiana Supreme Court's finding. What difference would it make if he had this little additional evidence about his relations to the police? Right, he didn't have a deal, but of course, as you say, he had a hope because they had stuff on him.
Well, so. I thought you were saying he had more than a hope, though.
He does.
That there were actual benefits that had already been
that
conferred.
Correct.
Well,
of course, that weakens your argument, right? Because if he'd already received the benefits, that would reduce his incentive to play ball.
I would say, Your Honor, from
Wouldn't it?
No.
Why not?
Because of this relationship that's going on between Gregory Scott Johnson.
Well, now you've lost me completely. I understand if he's promised benefits. I understand that, which we don't have here. But if he's received the benefits already, how does that increase his incentive to testify?
For one thing, the police could have always taken it back.
So is that what you think? Do you really think it would have aided the truth-determining function of the jury to go down these byways?
I do, Your Honor, yes. I think that it is. Johnson's testimony is critical. He portrays himself as...
I don't understand that. Why is it confessed? Why is Johnson's testimony critical?
There, at the guilt phase, there are two defenses, both of which... rely or have as their premise the same fact, and that fact is that Mark Weishart is crazy. Either he's one, crazy, so crazy to confess to something he didn't do, or two, that he is so crazy that if he committed the offense, he's not guilty by reason of insanity. Looking first at the insanity, there's credible evidence of insanity. You've got three experts who testify, two of which say he's insane. At that point, in Indiana law, the definition was the defense had to prove, by preponderance of the evidence, that Mark Weishart could not conform his conduct to the requirements of the law. Gregory Scott Johnson testifies that his brother asked him on quite a few occasions to, quote, make it look like I'm crazy.
And
his brother, i.e. Mark Weishart.
You think the police told him, or the prosecutor told him to make that up?
Gregory Scott Johnson testified during the state post-conviction proceeding that statement was never made.
All right. Ms. Longsharp, is it true that Mr. Johnson acknowledged committing the church burglary?
Yes.
Okay. Is it also true that he acknowledged that he was not charged?
He said that charges had yet to be filed, I believe, is his exact testimony.
Okay. So that's in the ether, right?
I mean, yes.
I mean, that's out there before the jury.
Correct.
With the jury free to infer that may or may not come to fruition, that is the charging of the jury, right? I mean, the charges being leveled against Mr. Johnson.
Could they have inferred that?
Well, let me put it another way. With that out there, did it cross elicit anything? Was the opportunity presented to elicit from Mr. Johnson,
yes,
or call a witness for the state?
Yes. On cross-examination, defense counsel asked Mr. Johnson about the church burglary in particular, whether he'd gotten any deal. You know, did you get a deal on that charge? Did you get this? Did you get that? And Johnson says unequivocally, no, I got nothing.
No, but the opportunity was also there to say, do you have any hope for, right? That question, I assume, was not asked. Okay. That could have been asked, could it have not?
Yes, it could.
And that could have been a strategic move, couldn't it, by a defense counsel to not ask that question and just leave it sort of pregnant there for the jury to think about, right?
I guess I would say no.
Why is that?
Because of the conduct of defense counsel in cross-examining Gregory Scott Johnson. Defense counsel is so desperate to go after anything on Johnson because of his importance. He's asking him things like, did you lie on a job application about your age?
I guess I just want to focus on whether or not the jury had a fair opportunity to consider whether we had a hope as opposed to a deal. I appreciate the distinction you're trying to draw here. But it is not any anticipated leniency out there before the jury when Johnson acknowledges he has not been charged and nothing is pursued.
But he says, I have no reason to lie, to cover up, to protect myself. Testimony on cross-examination.
I appreciate his self-serving remarks. I'm just trying to get to the point of whether or not the jury had a fair opportunity to consider whether Johnson's testimony was impacted by the possibility of charges being later filed, which is the thrust of the benefit that you're suggesting needed to be explored.
Well, I think it's more than that, though, Your Honor. I think that when you look at Gregory Scott Johnson's testimony and the way he portrays himself, and that he's there, you know, doesn't want to be, has to be, because it's just the right thing to do with his moral transformation and all. When you look at him that way, it's if he's got a bias in favor of anybody in that courtroom, it's Mark Weishart. When in fact,
well, why is that inconsistent that he would portray himself as somebody not wanting to be there, except that he's driven to tell the truth? And we also know that he's a felon and a potentially charged felon in the church burglary, and that's brought out. I guess I don't understand why those are inconsistent postures for Johnson to have, and whether or not they haven't been fully aired, if you will, before the jury.
Had the jury heard that Gregory Scott Johnson was beholding to the state and had actually received things for his testimony, and even more than that, the extent to which he wielded power, if you will, over the police.
Well,
are you looking at like footnote 50, going back to the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion,
yes,
where
Honor.
The Indiana Supreme Court itself says the evidence indicated that the police department did not file and drop charges, and we believe certainly Johnson was aware of the benefits he was receiving for providing what the police thought to be valuable testimony. So I suppose there's no real question, in light of the state court's finding, that Johnson knew he was getting benefits from the
yes.
police.
I mean, there are three very important, in our opinion, state court findings. Two of them are in footnote 50. The state did not file and drop charges against Johnson that you referred to. The finding that Johnson is, quote, aware that he is getting benefits for his testimony in the upcoming trial. And the third is the state court acknowledges that Johnson's testimony must have had an adverse effect on.
But there's also a fourth finding. I don't see how you can pick and choose. Namely, that the cross-examination indicated that Johnson had been involved in a number of burglaries for which he was never charged.
And I believe, Your Honor, if you'll look at the last couple of pages in our reply brief on this, we take issue with the state's contention that that's accurate. That just simply is not accurate. There is not reference to a number of burglaries. There is reference to two in Johnson's testimony. And as I said, that is cleared up with Officer Tom Hay, who testifies it's one.
Yeah, so, Ms. Longsharp, is it your position that defense counsel in this case should have called a representative of the state to say that the statute hasn't run, that there's potential to be charged, to make it more explicit that this hope for benefit? What could we do here to make this record whole in the sense that you would say would have satisfied a jury?
Johnson's false testimony should have been corrected. At that moment, it was up once Johnson misrepresented his motives.
Wait. Misrepresented his motive?
Well, I'm sorry. Misrepresented his, I have no reason to lie, to cover up charges having yet to be filed.
You have to misrepresent a fact. Well, what was the fact that you think he misrepresented?
Well, I think we can begin with this. Charges have yet to be filed. The suggestion with that is they are going to be.
Well, I don't get
it. He's going to skate on
that. You lost me.
I apologize.
Who said that?
Pardon?
Who said the charges are yet to be filed?
That's Gregory Scott Johnson's testimony.
Yeah, so he's saying, he is speaking that they are yet to be filed.
Yes.
He's acknowledging that sword is above him, right?
Yes.
So isn't he, in effect, acknowledging something about that pendency or potential?
He's acknowledging they're probably going to charge him, yeah.
Yeah, that exposes a concern on his part, does it not?
But you're saying that's a lie?
Charges, they'd already decided to let him skate on that.
They'd already decided not to. So
yes.
You're actually saying that a decision had been made and charges were not yet to be filed.
That's correct.
Well, wait.
That's what,
that doesn't sound like English to me. I don't get that. Charges have not yet to be filed.
Charges that there were not going to be any charges filed. The prediction was that the police had already committed themselves not to pursue this.
That's what the evidence is, yes, Your Honor.
You really think the government is supposed to jump up and said, say, he said charges have yet to be filed. That could be understood to mean charges will be filed. Is that what he's supposed to say? He's supposed to interpret the witness and then say to the jury, I mean, really, it doesn't sound realistic.
I don't think it's appropriate, with due respect, to somehow look at the government and say, you know, gee, they didn't have to do anything. They did not turn over the evidence upon.
No, I'm just trying to see how this trial would actually be conducted. But look, let me ask you. There are other issues I want to ask about. This juror who gave an affidavit about the lie detector.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what if anything was done with his affidavit? So he submits this affidavit, and forget the other two. There's no evidence of those other two. Just this juror. So he submits this affidavit. So what kind of proceeding ensues after the affidavit?
There was a post-conviction hearing where evidence was taken in state court. The affidavit comes in at the hearing.
And what other evidence was presented?
That on the juror's testimony was taken by affidavit.
So what else was at the hearing? What kind of hearing? Is a hearing just with an affidavit?
No. I'm sorry, Your Honor. This is an extensive post-conviction hearing where the police officers, for example, testified
about... But there's a piece of it that's about the juror misconduct or something.
Correct.
Extraneous effort.
Yes.
And that piece of the hearing just consists of the affidavit.
Yes, sir.
That no effort was made to call this... Well, it was many years earlier, of course.
I mean, Indiana post-conviction law specifically permits...
So how could one possibly deal with such a thing, right? So many years. How many years after the trial was this hearing? Roughly.
My gut is about 10, maybe.
10 years.
Maybe.
So what could you do?
Maybe more.
You
have
this so could Weishart's then lawyer have called the witness to testify?
Sure. Or the state could have called. The post-conviction hearing was an adversary proceeding, or the state could have called the juror to testify or sought a counter-affidavit as is commonly done in state practice.
What would be a counter-affidavit? Who would file a counter-affidavit?
If there was something else to add to it, or they disagree with the content of the affidavit.
So your proposition is that when this affidavit was submitted, the state had to do something? Is that the idea? Is that your
the burden?
Grammar
once
argument?
The extraneous conduct is the extraneous influence is proven, then the burden shifts to the state.
Concretely, so once that affidavit was in there, you think that required the state to either lose or it had to present evidence? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Present evidence
or take whatever steps it felt necessary meet its burden.
Develop evidence of some sort.
I mean, I was not post-conviction counsel, but post-conviction on this issue, post-conviction counsel's obligation is to bring forth the evidence of the extraneous contact. They did that. Mm-hmm. I'd like to close by saying that Gregory Scott Johnson single-handedly, make it look like I'm crazy, took down the insanity defense, the mental illness aspect of the false confession theory, and at the penalty phase, no additional evidence was presented, and the state for the first time was obligated to prove beyond a reasonable doubt Mark Weishart intentionally killed. He was charged at the guilt phase with felony murder. At the penalty phase, it's the first time the state's obliged to prove the existence of the sole aggravating factor, which is intentionality. The state Supreme Court's finding that Johnson's testimony, make it look like I'm crazy, must have had an adverse impact on the insanity phase. And on the